rte.ie/Mooney.
West Antarctica is the place that we're most concerned about because it sits on the seabed. It's if you can imagine an ice cube in a shallow puddle of water, it'd be sitting on the base on the ground, and that's what West Antarctica does. And it's surrounded by the ocean, and because the ocean is wet, it's above freezing, and it delivers actually quite a lot of heat. And so the small changes in Earth's temperature that we've seen over the past century are transmitted quite effectively through the ocean to the South Pole, and it's melting the ice at its edge.
That colossal sound of hundreds of tons of ice melting and collapsing into surrounding polar seas has become a resounding alarm call for each and every one of us, signalling the warming of our planet and the existential threat which it poses. Each week during the month of July here on Mooney Goes Wild, we're hearing from a variety of leading voices on the global crisis of climate change. Our focus today is on a newly published study which reveals that parts of the Antarctic are losing ice 5 times faster than 20 years ago. Sea levels rise as these glaciers slide into the surrounding Southern Ocean. The East Antarctic ice sheet contains enough ice to raise sea levels by about 60 metres. It had been considered stable, but recent research has found even this stronghold is showing signs of melting. Of more immediate concern, however, is the loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is dissolving rapidly. More than 100 metres of ice thickness has been lost in the worst hit places. Its complete loss would drive global sea levels up by about 5 metres, flooding coastal cities around the world. Professor Andy Shepherd is a polar scientist from the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds. He's also director of the Centre for Polar Observation and Modelling in the United Kingdom. He recently spoke with Dr. Richard Collins about the extraordinary thinning of ice sheets inside Antarctica and what the consequences of this process could be.
Professor Andrew Shepherd, you are what I would call an extremophile. Like the emperor penguin and the albatrosses and things, you seek out the most remote and isolated places in the world, but such people are always interesting, I must say. Shades of Shackleton and Scott and Amundsen and I'm going outside, I may be some time. It's a very romantic image. Is it true to form?
For myself, perhaps not. I started out life as a physicist and I use satellites, which it turns out are the best way to monitor Earth, in fact, from space. And since the past 10 or 15 years, I do visit the polar regions because it's important to collect measurements on the ground to make sure what we see from space is correct.
Now, the Antarctic, it's hard for somebody like me to even begin to grasp what the Antarctic is. This is an enormous landmass, twice the size of Australia, bigger than Europe, covered in ice. It boggles the human imagination to try and get some sort of a picture of it. Can you amplify that a little bit for us?
So we consider Antarctica to be in two halves, really. East Antarctica is, as you say, it's an island. If you took the ice away, it would be an island above sea level, and the ice sits on top of that island. And that's most of the continent. It's about 9/10 of the ice that's there. It turns out that part of the ice sheet is quite stable because it's on an island, and so it's really only affected by changes in air temperature. And it's really cold in Antarctica, as most people would imagine. It's probably minus 40 degrees centigrade on average throughout the year. And so we can expect not a great deal of change in most of East Antarctica, even if climate warms by a lot. But West Antarctica is the place that we're most concerned about because it sits on the seabed. It's if you can imagine an ice cube in a shallow puddle of water, it'd be sitting on the base on the ground. And that's what West Antarctica does. And it's surrounded by the ocean. And because the ocean is wet, it's above freezing. And it delivers actually quite a lot of heat. And so the small changes in Earth's temperature that we've seen over the past century are transmitted quite effectively through the ocean to the South Pole, and it's melting the ice at its edge.
We are inclined to look at people like me as very static, a kind of fixed, immutable entity. But in fact, the Antarctic is a process, isn't it? You have ice building up and you have ice melting away. It's continuous flow thing, is it? Presumably snow puts layers on top of the ice while thaw removes it from the bottom. Is this a valid model of it?
Yeah, I mean, the ice sheet is part of Earth's hydrological cycle, so anything that arrives at the surface through snow, fall, and in very, very few places in Antarctica through rainfall, eventually makes its way through the ice sheet and back into the ocean again as glaciers move it downstream and carve off icebergs when they hit the ocean. And so it's sometimes simpler to think of the ice sheet as a bathtub full of water with the plug out and the taps on. And so if the taps are running at the same speed as the water is draining out of the plug, then the level of the water in the bath will stay the same. But if you turn the taps up a little bit, then it'll start to fill up. And if you turn them down a bit, then it'll start to empty. And today, in West Antarctica at least, it's the latter case. There's more ice pouring out through the glaciers than is being replenished by snow inland.
So expenditure is outrunning input or income. So it's a kind of a balance sheet model. So the balance sheet is against things now. The place is shrinking, or the ice is slowly or beginning to shrink. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's not slowly, unfortunately. We can, and have done for many years, we can chart the retreat of the polar ice sheets over what we would consider to be the glacial cycle since the last ice age by looking at the rocks left behind by glaciers as they retreat. And this is common. If you go and look in mountainous areas, you'll see moraines, as we call them, piles of debris which mark the historical extent of a glacier. And that's the case in Antarctica, although in West Antarctica those moraines are on the seabed where the glacier used to be. And we can be sure how quickly Antarctica is retreating as a consequence of the ice age that we're in. And it's probably at most 10 or 20 metres per year moving inland. But actually, over the past 30 or 40 years since we've had satellite measurements, we can see in West Antarctica that the ice is retreating about 50 times as fast as that, about a kilometre per year. And that's not right. And that's because the ocean in front of the ice sheet is too warm. It's not that warm. You'd still be really chilly if you were swimming in it. It's only half a degree centigrade above the temperature that would keep the ice sheet stable. But that's too much. That melts from the base of the glaciers 5 metres of ice per year.
The image I have of it in my mind is of, yes, the ice over the land and then a sort of lip protruding out into the sea, the sort of thing you get in these films of Arctic explorer, Antarctic explorers and things. Relatively thin coating of a sheet of ice out over the sea. Presumably that's in contact with hot water, of course, and therefore that is going to thaw. Well, now, when that is gone, the glacier is now on rock, rock substrate, which is not going to be at above 0 degrees centigrade. Will melting stop in that situation? Is it a question of all the ice outside disappearing into the water and the ice on the rock itself staying put?
So that's right for East Antarctica. If you melt the glaciers that are currently extending out into the ocean, then the ice sheet there would just retreat further inland. There's a bit of a adjustment because sea levels would rise as well as a consequence, and so more of the ice would be surrounded by the ocean. But more or less, East Antarctica would, we expect, retreat to a new stable position above ground. But West Antarctica is entirely in an ocean basin, and what would happen there is the ice would just continue to retreat until it's all disappears, and that would be an important change because West Antarctica has enough ice to raise sea levels by 3 or 4 metres.
Andrew, are you into apocalyptic visions or that sort of thing? Can you sketch for us the dire consequences of sea level rise for flooded cities and dreadful effects and whole areas of the world inundated?
Yeah, people have in the past thought about sea level rise and the impacts for low-lying islands, Pacific islands, really remote places. And we see that happening, but it's a convenient diversion from the way that sea level rise affects most people. The vast majority of people affected on Earth are going to be in coastal cities. And it's not the gradual rise of the ocean that is the problem. It's that on top of tides and storms. And when you add all three together, it causes more flooding, episodic flooding. And that happens rarely today in most coastal cities because the defences have been built to withstand everyday events. But if we raise sea levels by a few tens of centimetres, that picture changes. So New York is a really good example. In 2012, there was a huge hurricane that hit New York, and it coincided with high tides, and it caused flooding. And that flooding was really quite devastating. Many people lost their lives in the hurricane itself. 50 square miles of land was flooded in lower Manhattan, and 20,000 properties were destroyed. And that happened once in 5 years. But if sea levels were 50 centimetres higher, which they will be in the next century, that sort of flooding will happen on a monthly, if not more frequent, basis. And that's not something that people can tolerate at all. And in fact, the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, has come up with a plan to deal with this, to protect lower Manhattan from future sea level rise. And there's a bill associated with that. It's tens of billions of dollars. So people should start to think more about episodic flooding and not when will my village be flooded by sea level rise. It's about the weather-induced floods.
Now, if we had an emperor penguin here and he could talk to us, what would he say about all this? Antarctica hasn't got a huge range of flora and fauna. I mean, there's something like 7 seals and sea lions and about 8 penguin species and things, and some cetaceans and so on. But it's not enormous, but they're very important in their way, and they look like being very much threatened. Or have you any kind of model of that in your head?
So actually, we can now study penguins from space, remarkably. There are a few animals that we can see from space. Mm. We can see whales in the ocean from space because they're really big. But we can see penguins from space because they leave mess on the ice. Their colonies are really filthy places. And they show up really well on the ice because it should otherwise be white, and it isn't where they live. And we can track penguin colonies from the stains that they leave on the ice. And they're not as static as we once thought, very similar to the ice sheet, in fact. Now we can monitor them. We see more colonies in other locations, for instance. We discover new ones. But we also see shrinking and moving colonies. And we're only now starting to fully understand the lifestyles of penguin colonies. And I think that we should expect new conclusions to be drawn about what forces them to change where they live and how frequently they do that.
Now, the image is slightly scary. The sea is warming up. Now, we can't do anything about cooling the sea down in perpetuity. So presumably, this has gone beyond the point of no return. If the imbalance has now gone in favour of thaw, we can't go back to the stage where the water would be cold enough that it would be stable again. Now, that is a daunting prospect. Another thought occurs on that if I have if I pour ice or icy water into the sea, it will cool somewhat, which is what we want worldwide. Will the thawing out of the ice down there reduce the temperature of the sea worldwide?
It has done. In fact, we've measured that in parts of the Southern Ocean. And the ice losses from the glaciers in West Antarctica do have an effect on the ocean. They cause it to be cooler and fresher because you're putting more ice into the sea. But the ocean is large. It's only a small effect, and it's quite local, and it's definitely not enough to cool down the whole column of the ocean. So the heat that's arriving at Antarctica is more or less on the seabed, which is 1.5 to 2 kilometres below the ocean surface. And when we lose icebergs or melting from the underside of floating glaciers, that cold water ends up as a cap on the ocean surface, and it doesn't really ever mix with the heat that's at the depth on the seabed. And so, unfortunately, it doesn't counter the effects of the warm ocean currents that are causing the melting today. But it's not true to say that we can't reverse these effects. If we did cool the ocean, and that's not an impossibility, if we did cool the ocean over a period of time, then we should expect the glaciers that are melting today to recover and return to their previous state, or at least stop losing ice at the rate they are today. And if we can warm the oceans in 50 or 100 years, then we can cool them again in 50 or 100 years.
Could we? How?
Well, I mean, the planet is warming because we've got too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and so there are many ways that we can reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We can capture some of it and store it as in solid form underground, and we can certainly stop putting as much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as we are today. I mean, the oceans today absorb a lot of the carbon dioxide that we're putting out, and that's caused them to warm. But if we stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at the rate we are today, we should expect no more rises and eventually a fall in temperature.
Would it fall if you removed the greenhouse effect? The radiation of heat into space would, you say, reduce gradually the temperature of the oceans and the planet?
I think eventually, if we reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, then the planet will start to cool again.
Well, looking back to when this happened last time, at the decay of the ice 10,000 years ago, 25,000 to 10,000 years ago, you get a massive melt in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere. And you get things like the Little Ice Age. And I've seen a theory expressed that this was due to cold water coming into subarctic regions, and this cold water deflected the ocean currents, and this is why Northern Europe, for instance, went into a terrible cold spell. You know, the Middle Ages right up to the 17th century, you had people skating on the Thames in London, that kind of thing. Will effects of that kind occur with the Antarctic?
I mean, Antarctica is a really important source of cold, fresh water for the entire planet. So we have a circulation in the ocean currents, which stretch from the north to the south pole and deliver heat around the planet. People might be familiar with the Gulf Stream, for instance, and that delivers warm water to northwestern Europe and keeps us hotter than we otherwise would be. And in order to keep that current going, believe it or not, we need very cold, fresh water in Antarctica. And it's really important that that's produced. And if we lose, and most of that's produced from floating ice shelves that stick out in the ocean, if we lose those ice shelves and we lose this source of cold, fresh water, then eventually that will disrupt these global ocean circulation patterns and change other parts of what we understand to be today's climate. So it's a possibility, and in some model experiments, we've seen changes in other weather patterns, other than just the simple global warming and ice melting that people tend to be familiar with.
Professor Andrew Shepherd, it has been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
And more information can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to researcher Sinead Renshaw and our series producer, Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.